The third case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Fred Pack Jr. For the appellant, Mr. Pack, is Mr. Timothy Wrench, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the State of South Dakota is Mr. Frank Geegan, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Wrench, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you very much. May it please the court and counsel. Despite producing one witness who was a seated Jackson County State's attorney who testified that the alleged victim basically recanted her story, my client Fred Pacht was convicted of rape and sexual contact and sentenced to life in prison plus 25 years. It is our position here today, Your Honors, that Fred Pacht did not receive a fair trial, and there are a number of reasons that he did not receive a fair trial. Rather than setting forth the facts, I will just jump right into the issues in somewhat of a different order in the brief so that I can try to get them in the time allotted. I'd like to move to the fifth issue in my brief, which deals with testimony by a forensic interviewer to the effect that she didn't think it was any big deal that this child had changed her story and testified in, on the one hand, that this abuse happened in one room and at trial happened in another. It's our position here today that one witness, and the law is clear on this, may not testify as to another witness's truth-telling capacity. And in this case, the forensic interviewer exceeded that which was allowed in the previous case law in this state for what forensic interviewers are allowed to tell a jury. Throughout all of the case law that we've had in this state, if you look at any case dealing with the forensic interviewer, at least the present state of the law, the forensic interviewers are allowed to talk about the general characteristics, and they're allowed to say whether or not they believe a child has some of these general characteristics. It's our position here that what Ms. Hawkins testified to in this case went far beyond that, because virtually it was a comment directly upon the child's testimony. It is also the position here that because she was basically giving a play-by-play of the testimony in pertinent parts, that that constitutes reversible error and requires a retrial. If I could point the court directly to the transcript at page 448 and 449, looking at just the questions and the way they are brought about relative what Laura Hawkins said to the jury will display how this far exceeds the bounds allowed. But before I go through that transcript, I need to set it up a little bit so that everybody understands just what the situation is.
Can you tell me, though, before you do that,
the jury did get to see the videotape of the child, of Hawkins interviewing the child. Is that right?
That is correct.
All right. Go ahead.
They did. They called the child to the stand first. The child testified very haltingly and did not say everything that was said on the videotape. And then the videotape was separately played before the jury. And that was with the consent of the defense because, of course, there were statements on the videotape that helped the defense as well. On the videotape, though, you'll note if you go through it, there are five separate instances where Laura Hawkins is asking this child where all of this occurred. And she says, it always occurred in my mother's room. Always occurred in my mother's room. Always occurred in my mother's room. She even draws a picture of her mother's room. Ms. Hawkins, as she's trained, understanding that it's important that we try to learn where these things occur, asks if it ever happened in the young girl's own bedroom. She says no. She repeatedly denies that it never happened in her bedroom. That's what the videotape will show. At trial, the child took the stand and shifted the story substantially. Said that it always happened in her own bedroom and never happened in her mother's bedroom. In addition to that, there were 11 other inconsistencies between the tape and what she testified to at trial, but the one we're concerned with here is basically where this act supposedly occurred. Now, rather than Ms. Hawkins testifying in a general way, children have memory problems, children sometimes will recount that it occurs in a different place, children have this stress, things like that, the prosecutor moves right in and asks the child forensic expert to comment directly upon the evidence. I've got to grab a sip of water.
While you're doing that, I read that, of course, in your brief and in the transcript, and it looks to me as if the prosecutor does ask the question in a way that you're indicating. But the answer appears to be just a general answer about children in general, where Hawkins doesn't really talk about this child specifically. Am I wrong about that?
I would disagree with you in that regard, and let me explain specifically why. First of all, the answer to the question, you have to look at the question and the answer. Secondly, when you look at what other interviewers have said in the past, they're talking about what the child basically told them during the course of their interview and how the child's characteristics can fit what the known characteristics of an abused child would be. In this case, when you look at the whole way the questions came about in front of the jury, it starts off, Ms. Stephan, and so if I tell you that ESB's testimony was that when she was here yesterday, was that this happened in her room, and I think on the tape we saw it was in her mom's room, does that cause you any great concern as someone who spends their career 30 years of working with the children and doing forensic interviews? I interpose the objection. It's allowed to answer, and the witness says, now, are you saying that she said it happened in her bedroom as opposed to mom and dad Fred's room? Question, yes. Answer, I guess had it been a radically different location, for instance, if she said it happened in a car, etc., and she goes on. She's commenting directly on the child's testimony in court. This is not a situation where she's saying, what we know about abused children is that they will say different things at different times. Had she said that, what we know about abused children is that they will say different things at different times, we'd have a different situation here. But we have the prosecutor basically saying, here's what the child testified to in court. Here's what she said to you. Does that cause you any concern?
But how is that much different than doing the permissible thing of saying, did this child exhibit these characteristics? It's not much different in my view.
Well, the reason that I believe that it's different is because you have the prosecutor saying, here's what she testified to. What do you think of that?
But how is that different than saying, did this child possess these characteristics?
Because it comments directly upon the testimony of the child in the proceeding, based upon the child's testimony previously in the proceeding after the prosecutor has explained what the child's testimony is. If we step into allowing the forensic experts to come in, the child experts to come in and start saying, well, you know, they said this here in court, and they said this previously, and I don't think that's a big deal. You're stepping away from the general in that you don't have someone saying, here's what the characteristics are. You, the jury, are free to determine, based upon my expertise, whether or not this child fits those characteristics. That's what we've looked at previously when this issue has been looked at. You look at State versus Cates. We note how the expert did not directly comment on the child's testimony. There's not been a case that we've had in South Dakota where the expert came right in and was just given the child's testimony in court and asked whether or not they thought that was a big deal. You get into the specifics of the answer, and really this becomes advocacy. It becomes bolstering the child's credibility. It invades the province of the jury because you have an expert saying, you know, I don't really think that's a big deal. I don't know that you really should concern yourselves with that. Now, when you take that and you look at it and you see that we're going from the general traits just listing before the jury so that they can decide for themselves what their province is to determine the credibility of the child, and having a forensic interviewer talk specifically about what the child said in court, that's where you get into the damage. You step back and you look at this case as a whole. We have a child who we know, if Alvin Palke, the Jackson County State's attorney, is to be believed, told Alvin that Fred never touched her peaches and that she wanted him to come home.
Let me just stop you there, because this just concerns me. Okay. Mr. Palke is acting as a defense counsel at that time? How does that go down? How does that happen that the 8-year-old child ends up alone in an interview with the defense attorney?
Well, the 8-year-old child was brought down by the grandmother and the family, and Mr. Palke was there in the courthouse in Martin, and they spoke to the child, and the child made these statements.
So this is really, I mean, after all these years, we think we have the procedure down where we don't have a child repeatedly interviewed, especially by people with an agenda, like a defense lawyer who wants to discredit the child. It just seems strange to me that I thought we had gotten this procedure down where we use forensic investigators. We don't have children repeatedly interviewed by state's attorneys, defense lawyers, along. And I guess there's nothing that can be done about that when the grandmother takes her down.
You know, the only thing that I can say in that regard is, I mean, I agree with you. I think we need to protect the kids and make sure that they're interviewed in an appropriate fashion. But in this case, we're left with the testimony of Alvin Palke that he asked her what happened, and she said Fred didn't touch her peaches and that she wanted him to come home. Now, whether or not that's proper, we still have that statement as it exists. We also have her testimony at trial under oath where she remembers talking to Mr. Palke and where I asked her, did you tell him the truth? And she said, yes, I told him the truth, although she told the jury that she told Alvin Palki that Fred had in fact touched her.
So now Mr. Palki is put in a position where his credibility is on the line, and apparently the jury believed the child and didn't believe Mr. Palki. I mean, why would a defense lawyer want to do that?
Well, I don't think it's fair to say that the jury disbelieved Mr. Palki. I think what the jury had is they have a lawyer coming in saying, you know, this is what the child said to me. They have it there. And then they have Laura Hawkins coming in and saying, you know, there's really, these kids will change their stories a lot. They'll say these different things. I don't think that this change of place should concern you. Things of that nature. I think there are other reasons that the jury did what they did. And I think really the reason they did what they did is because we didn't get to bring out all of the relevant information. We didn't get to have the forensic interviewer abide by the rules, and they were allowed to run rampant over us and testify in this fashion.
Well, I agree with you that the Mr. Palki thing is irrelevant to our decision today. I was just curious to know how that went down.
And I'll tell you, I defended this case, and he was the only witness I called, and I must tell you, I didn't think I could get it any better than that, the child saying she told him the truth and putting him on there saying this is what she said to me. Now, with all of that said, on this issue, I will just say, we've never had a case where you get to say to the forensic interviewer, hey, they testified thusly, what do you think? That is directly within the rule, that is directly a violation, and constitutes reasons for a new trial. Now, I'd like to move to one other issue, as I see my time is rapidly expiring, if that's all right. I want to move to the issue regarding, I guess we'll call it the third-party perpetrator issue, although I've specified it differently in my brief. It's the first issue I raised. In essence, a third-party perpetrator ruling was entered at the beginning of the trial, which didn't allow us to ask whether or not anybody else may have done something. It's our position here that the third-party perpetrator rule was mechanistically applied in such a way to deprive us of the opportunity to cross-examine the witnesses and to present the theory of our case, which would be, we don't know why this little girl is telling this, but we need to figure out the circumstances surrounding the disclosure to see if what she's saying has anything to do with anything else. In that regard, there are two conversations that are key. The first conversation was introduced in the direct testimony by the state through the grandmother and through the mother, and that was concerning the disclosure the little girl made it around Christmas time. And the state gets into this. They start asking, what did she say? What did she say? The answers come in. I step back, want to cross-examine these witnesses about some other things that were said at that time. We know some other things were said because the grandmother testified as such before the jury, before I was shut down on asking those questions. We know at the time that in front of the jury it was presented, this little girl is simply disclosing that her father did this, and we're not allowed to question how at that time they were worried about what type of contact or how she knew a little neighbor boy and how she was having, there were concerns about this little neighbor boy and how her mother was actually angry about her, yelling at her over this neighbor boy, and that was the circumstances surrounding this disclosure. The state gets into the testimony about what occurred. They open the door, plain and simple on it, regardless of a third-party perpetrator ruling. We come in, try to effectively cross-examine, and we're not allowed to ask these questions. What effect does that have?
Before you do that, I just want to be clear about which of these witnesses you preserved your right to argue this on appeal. I don't think there's any question about the sheriff. You objected, made an offer of proof. But I wasn't clear whether you really preserved, because this was a motion in limine, whether you really preserved this issue with respect specifically to Shauna and the victim.
Sure. With the grandmother, I approached the bench, explained that I wanted an opportunity to question about these matters, was told that I couldn't, we'd move on, and I did question about certain aspects where the grandmother said that at the point in time there were concerns about the neighbor boy, and I brought out how the mother was actually yelling at the child during that time. I was precluded from going further. I don't know what it was Shanna Pact would have said about this because I wasn't allowed to ask it. Although, from the beginning of the record, where we're talking about what they're claiming is third-party perpetrator, I'm preserving it. As I'm in with the witnesses, I'm preserving it. And even later on, as I lay down my record after the time of they've testified, I specify what I would have asked, what it would have done for the case, how it would have gone to this credibility battle. And specifically, even as to the mother, there's a specific point in the transcript They bring in her testimony about this conversation at page 358. At the end of her testimony, I specify that I would have questioned her, but am not because of the court's ruling. So I believe that the issues have been preserved and that I made a record from the beginning of that trial throughout the end of that trial about how we believed we were not allowed to properly cross-examine these particular witnesses.
And it's three. Three witnesses?
Well, there are two. There's the mother and the grandmother, and then there's Sheriff John Walker, which I specify in my brief that they go into this subsequent conversation that was about a week after the fact, where Johnny Walker is allowed to talk about what's in that conversation, and it is allowed to describe to the jury and portray before the jury that this person is being uncooperative and in denial. And the reason he thought that, or at least one of the reasons he thought that, was because immediately she's throwing out the name of this neighbor boy as being a possible source for the stains in the panties. It was our position that once they get into that, portraying in front of the jury that this conversation was in denial and misleading and uncooperative, but we get to delve into the reasons for that. And in the offer of proof, Agent Walker, or I should say Sheriff Walker, admitted that that was one of the things that he was talking about when she was uncooperative and in denial. Overall, with these witnesses, we weren't allowed to flesh out what it was that they had to say because we couldn't ask them what the context was of the initial disclosure around Christmas time and whether or not there were concerns with this neighbor boy, whatever concerns they might be, as well as about the conversation that occurred about a week after when Agent Walker or Sheriff Walker is talking to the grandmother at her house and is claiming to the jury that she's being uncooperative and in denial and things like that. With that said, we would suggest that the right to confront and cross-examine witnesses, the right to present a defense, and due process was violated by virtue of not allowing us to ask these questions when we're dealing with a credibility battle, not only of the child, but of the mother, of the grandmother, and even potentially Sheriff Walker. With that, I'd like to move to a novel issue, a unique issue, which deals with how a jury should be instructed when an indictment says what it says. And at first, I will concede that time is not of an essence in an offense like this, but we are dealing with an allegation that started on or between, not on or about, started off very broad. Well, actually, it started off specifically one day in January 2004, then moved from June to January over 2003 and 2004, and then upon the appropriate motions for bills, a particular was limited down to June 9th through 11th, and then by the time of trial, we know that the dates are dates certain, June 6th through 9th. It is our position here that under State versus Sonnen and the authorities cited in State versus Sonnen, that when you go to trial and you have dates certain alleged in the indictment, whether time is of the essence or not, and when the defense relies upon that, and if there's substantial evidence in the record that would be an alibi, that can constitute a due process deprivation.
Is it a matter that Sonnen was tied to an alibi case? We don't have an alibi here.
It does matter, I believe, that it's tied to an alibi because the law has never addressed anything other than an alibi. However, the way that the due process is dealt with is how it affects the defense. And the only ways that it's been before courts is because it affects the defense in the sense that you can't improperly expand the dates in the indictment to vitiate someone's alibi defense. In this case, we have something that's similar, that's analogous to alibi, which is, in essence, victim alibi. That the victim is someplace else based upon the record. Now, the mother testified on cross initially that the victim stayed with her over the weekend that Shanna was in the hospital. Then on redirect, she changes her tune and she says, no, she could go back and forth. Then on recross, I come back and say, now, you just told us this, and she couldn't walk to these houses. They were too far away. Are you sure about this? And she comes back to the position that the child has stayed there over the weekend. On top of that, besides the natural mother saying that, we have statements from Evelyn herself to social worker Mike Bakley that she was staying with her mother while her grandmother was in the hospital. We also have that verified in other ways. The state will say, well, Shanna Pack thought that ESB was staying at Fred's house, yet Shanna Pack herself admits on cross-examination that she was in Rapid City and she doesn't really know where ESB would. And the simple fact of it is based upon one view of the record, we have something that's very analogous to alibi. That is, that the victim was elsewhere during the time in question. We argued it as such. We go into a trial based upon June 6th through the 9th, and we come out with someone with an instruction that says on or about, and on top of that, you have a videotape that shows acts could have occurred from Halloween to Thanksgiving. So it's our position here that in this case, the use of the instruction, which was instruction number 29, constituted a violation of due process because we all agreed going in what was at issue, and it changed at the end, thus depriving us of that substantial argument that we tried to make for the jury, but which could be rejected based upon the instruction. With that, I would say the Johnny Walker issue flows into the others. The sufficiency of evidence, I'd stand on my brief, and I thank you for listening to me.
Thank you, Mr. Ranch. Mr. Geegan, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. As you know, the present appeal stems from a report of sexual abuse that was said to have taken place back in June of 2003. The record reflects that the victim in this case, ESB, was living with, it was being taken care of, raised by the defendant and his wife, Shana Pack, the child's grandparents. According to Shana, she described it as a sad story because her daughter, the victim's mother, didn't want the child, so she, being Shana, decided to raise the ESB by herself. The victim, therefore, became quite attached to both Shana and the defendant. A review of the record indicates when the child was approximately 8 years old, Shana was hospitalized in Rapid City for several days due to a broken jaw that she suffered at the hands of the defendant. When she was asked if she remembered the date of that incident, Shana Pack testified that I believe it was around June 6th, if I'm correct. Shana indicated the defendant drove her to the hospital just to drop her off. The defendant then returned home to Martin, South Dakota, where, according to Shana, he was the victim's primary caregiver and took care of the victim day to day. A couple of weeks after returning home from the hospital, Shana was doing the laundry when she noticed a pair of children's underwear that had blood on it. She indicated that the blood was in what was described as the crotch part of the panties. She questioned the victim regarding the blood, but the victim indicated that the underwear belonged to her older sister. Shana therefore indicated that was it. She simply put the underwear in the dirty laundry and forgot about the whole thing. It was approximately 2 months later, in September of 2003, when Shana was again doing the laundry, and this time she noticed what she described as a greenish-colored stain on the victim's underwear. As before, she attempted to question the victim regarding the stain, but again the victim claimed she didn't know what it was. It was shortly after Christmas that Shana talked to her daughter, the victim's natural mother, regarding the stains that she had found. Shana testified that that wasn't normal for a little girl. That wasn't supposed to be happening to her underwear, so she wanted to find out what was happening. The record discloses, though, that the victim's reaction was always the same thing. She just started to cry. She responded the same way when she was questioned by her mother. Ms. Dubray testified that the child just acted scared. She put her head down, she started to play with her hands, and she wanted to cry. The victim, however, was ultimately able to confide in her mother and grandmother that she'd been sexually molested by the defendant. Arrangements were then made to take the child to Rapid City so she could be examined by Dr. Lori Strong, a physician who specializes in the area of child abuse. Dr. Strong testified that the victim described for her in childlike terms how the defendant had put his hot dog inside her peaches, was the terminology she used when referring to her private parts. An indictment was ultimately filed charging the defendant with first-degree rape and sexual contact with a minor. That brings me to the first issue the state would like to address here today, that being whether or not the trial court erred in instructing the jury that the state did not establish with exact certainty the date of the alleged offense, but only that it happened on or about the time alleged. Pursuant to Pattern Jury Instruction 1-11-6, the trial court instructed the jury, the indictment charges that the offense was committed on or between a certain date. The proof did not establish with certainty the exact date of the offense alleged. It is sufficient if the evidence establishes beyond a reasonable doubt that the offense was committed on a date reasonably near the date alleged. That instruction was consistent with the prior holdings of this court. State does not have to allege a specific date when time is not a material element of the offense.
What if the state agrees that it's going to specify the dates on or instead of on or about, they're specifying on or between?
You'd be referencing the defendant's motion for bail in particular. The trial court specifically found that although pursuant to the defendant's motion, those dates were narrowed down from June 2003 to January 2004 to on or between June 6th to 9th, the trial court stated, and I quote, the defendant's motion for bail in particular did not in any way require the state to prove it was specifically between those two dates. According to the court, it does not require the state to establish with certainty the exact dates of the offense, only again that it occurred on a date reasonably near the time. The defendant has cited to no authority, and the state certainly isn't aware of any, that a motion for bail in particulars changes the law and instantaneously makes time a material element of the offense.
When the indictment was read to the jury, though, at the beginning of the case, was the original indictment read, or was the language changed so that they were telling the jury it happened on or between?
I believe the original, I could be in error, but I believe the original that was read and it was specified that date was later narrowed down to specifically June 6th or 9th, pursuant to the defense request for bill of particulars.
Well, that's what Sonnen says. If it is limited, if the state limits their allegation to a certain date, then you got to prove it. That's the exception to the rule, to the general rule of on or about. And it looks to me like that's exactly what happened.
Even assuming that is correct, Justice Zinner, the state will submit that there's more than ample evidence in the record to establish that the incident in question did take place between June 6th and 9th. Now, in that regard, the defendant concedes, that he had no alibi per se. He argues, however, that what he had was what he refers to as an inverse alibi. According to the defendant, the evidence supposed to show that the victim was with her natural mother during the time period in question. What the defendant's argument ignores, however, is the testimony from the victim's mother that the victim was also with the defendant during that time period in question. When called to testify, Ms. DeBray was specifically asked, did she, referring to the victim, also stay at the house with Fred? Answer, yes. Question, so she did what she usually does. She spends time at both houses. Again, the answer was yes. Question, that was common for ESB. Answer, yes. The defendant also ignores the testimony of his own wife that he was the victim's primary caregiver and took care of her day to day while she was in the hospital, she being, again, Shayna Pack. The jury also heard the videotaped interview the child did with Laura Hawkins, in which the victim indicated that, yes, since she, referring to Shayna Pack, was in the hospital, I was with my dad. The state would submit that, therefore, there was ample evidence in the record for the jury to find that the defendant had the means and opportunity to sexually abuse the child. This court, on several occasions, has said that a purported alibi that still leaves it possible for the defendant to commit the crime is no alibi at all. Here, despite the defense assertions to the contrary, he had no alibi, inverse or otherwise. Testimony and record from all three witnesses establishes clearly that the victim was with the defendant during that time period in question while he was not at work. The second issue the state would like to respond to here today is the defendant's argument that the trial court erred in not allowing him to pursue evidence that a neighbor boy did it. Now, the state is aware that the defendant must be given or afforded a meaningful opportunity to present a defense. As indicated in the state's brief, however, that meaningful opportunity is not absolute or without limitations. The defendant, as well as the state, is bound by established rules of evidence designed to ensure fairness and reliability during the course of the trial. It is the trial court's duty to ensure that those rules of evidence are complied with. This court has said repeatedly that the trial court's evidentiary rulings are presumed to be correct and will not be reversed on appeal absent an abuse of discretion. In this particular case, the trial court, in denying the defendant's motion for offer of proof, specifically said the only thing we have regarding Hernandez, the neighbor boy, is a name, that he was a neighbor boy. According to the court, there is no other linkage that would in any way whatsoever connect the alleged sexual assault to the neighbor boy.
So what's the harm of letting it in?
We're bound by the established rules of evidence. The statute requires that prior to admission, the court has to determine if the evidence in question is relevant. When confronted or presented with third-party perpetrator evidence, the court's required to do a balancing test.
Did the
importance of the evidence to the defendant, as well as the state's interests in orderly trials and exclusion of irrelevant or unreliable testimony.
Did the defendant represent to the trial court that they were trying to get this in for third-party perpetrator purposes?
Yes, there was lengthy discussions that the evidence was indirectly according to defense counsel, third-party perpetrator evidence, but in essence what he wanted to do was use it in essence for impeachment purposes in reference to the victim.
But normally we are pretty open to allowing cross-examination for purposes of challenging credibility. Why, you know, if you're shutting that off, isn't there a problem here?
No problem, because there was no credible evidence to indicate that the victim was involved in a relationship with a neighbor boy, let alone a sexual one. There's no evidence in the record to support the defense assertion that the victim lied and fabricated these accusations in order to protect the neighbor boy.
Well, we don't know that because evidence never got in front of the jury.
The defendant was given an opportunity, however, to make an offer of proof. His offer of proof was limited to we wanted to question Sheriff Walker in reference to the conversation he had with Shayna Pat. During that offer of proof, Sheriff Walker specifically testified that Shane had made mention of the neighbor boy in an attempt to point him in the direction of another suspect, to make him think that someone else may have committed this crime in hopes of protecting the defendant. Sheriff Walker testified during the defendant's offer of proof that he felt that Shayna Pack was being overly protective of the defendant. She obviously didn't want to see him charged with this, so she was just throwing out anybody's name. The state would therefore submit that the evidence in question was nothing more than baseless innuendo, and the trial court properly excluded the same.
Doesn't that kind of give the state the opportunity to put their spin on it and deny the defense the opportunity to put their spin on it?
Not so long as the defendant would have come up with some credible evidence. Here, the only reference to the neighbor boy was not from the victim herself, but from the defendant's wife, Shayna Pack. And again, every indication in the record, as was found by the trial court, it was an attempt to mislead the police into believing that there was another potential suspect when the evidence, in fact, established that it was a defendant who assaulted and sexually molested the victim.
But didn't it open the door when they asked the when the officer was able to testify as to his opinion that they were uncooperative? Doesn't that open the door?
Specifically, again, during the offer of proof that the officer was testifying to in reference to Shanna's being uncooperative with the investigation was in reference to the pair of panties that she had found with blood or the greenish stain and her subsequent contact or attempted contact to the Department of Social Services. When asked about those underwear and the bottle of baby oil that she had turned over to the authorities, Shayna Pack denied knowing anything about it and wanted to know where Sheriff Walker had gotten that information. And each and every opportunity, when Sheriff Walker attempted to pursue that with Shayna Pack, she would simply start to cry. The state would submit that even regardless of whether or not that testimony had come in, there was still more than ample evidence in the record which would point to the defendant. We have the testimony of Dr. Lori Strong, the physician.
But was Dr. Strong or Ms. Hawkins informed that there was this boy, that there was a mention of this boy, so they could explore that with the child?
I can't answer that affirmatively, yes or no.
You can look at the videotape, Ms. Hawkins does not explore that issue with the child.
That's very possibly true, because the only individual, again, it wasn't the victim who had made reference to the neighbor boy, it was Shayna Pack, the defendant's wife. And again, all the indications in the record show that it was an attempt to deliberately mislead the police.
But wasn't there, maybe my recollection's wrong, but wasn't there just one other reference where the mother, Betty, made some kind of angry confrontation with this child about her running around with this boy? Wasn't there something to that extent?
I believe my recollection of that conversation that occurred shortly after Christmas was they were questioning the victim what had happened, what her explanation was for the blood stains and the greenish stains in her underwear. And the mother had specifically asked if she had been molested either by the defendant or her natural father. And I believe the child's response was that it was Fred, the defendant. At which point in time, the mother became upset because she had been molested. I don't think she held any animosity or ill will toward the child itself. She simply stated she didn't know what to do, having found out that...
So there was no confrontation about this child running around with some boy?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
The last issue the state would like to briefly touch on specifically regards the testimony of Laura Hawkins when she was asked what, if any, relevance or significance to attach to the fact that the victim told law enforcement that the abuse in question happened in her mother's bedroom and then at trial testified that it happened in her bedroom. According to Ms. Hawkins, it wouldn't surprise her at all if a child would do that. She indicated it would only be relevant if there was what she referred to as a radically different location. If the child had changed the story and testified, for example, that it happened outside or in the vehicle. The state would submit you have to look at her testimony in proper context. Ms. Hawkins was allowed to testify without any objection from defense counsel that it was very common for children to blur multiple incidents, especially if the incidents involved the same or similar conduct. She told the jury, again, and I quote, it's difficult even for adults to go back in the past and talk about what was different from one time to the other. She therefore testified, it shouldn't surprise us that a child would have trouble sorting that out. That was consistent, the state would submit, with this court's prior holdings that not only may a witness testify as to the general characteristics of sexually abused children, they may also tie or compare those characteristics to a specific victim. The state would furthermore submit that the testimony was admissible in an attempt to refute the defendant's assertions that the victim's testimony was tainted. From the very outset of the trial, the defendant attempted to persuade the jury that the victim's statements were full of inconsistencies and that she therefore had some sort of ulterior motive for accusing him of the abuse. If you look at the record, the defendant in his opening statement told the jury, I'm going to suggest to you that the evidence in this case will show that there are many reasons why she might say something like this. The defense counsel then went on to tell the jury, after referring to all the alleged inconsistencies in the victim's statements, that he wants you to review those, to listen to what she says on the stand, and to also look at what other people have said about her statements. The state would submit that having raised the issue, the defendant is in no position to complain on appeal. The state put those in proper context. Now, unless there are any further questions from the court, the state would simply close by asking that the defendant's conviction be affirmed in all respects.
Thank you, Mr. Gee.
Thank you.
Mr. Wrench, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
As it relates to the indictment was read to the jury with the dates June 6th through 9th inserted as if they existed in the indictment. The indictment originally said on or between June 2003 to January 6th, 2004. At the time that it was read before the jury, it said on or between June 6th through 9th, and that's how we proceeded, and those are the dates that were always operative throughout the course of this trial. As it relates to Justice Konenkamp's question regarding whether or not there were concerns about the neighbor boy during this Christmas interview, you will find that at page 251, 252 of the trial transcript. That is the time when Shanna Pack, the grandmother, is describing how the mother, Betty DeBray, is angrily questioning ESB over what happened, and at that time there were concerns about a neighborhood boy. It would be our position here that the court misapplied the rules of evidence. The court went in, entered a third-party perpetrator in limine ruling, and then refused to allow questions about anything even remotely possibly or what the state claimed was related to a possible third-party perpetrator, even though the door was opened. The simple fact of the matter is the moment they ask about the Christmas conversation, we get to ask about what else was said. The simple fact of the matter is that the moment they ask Johnny Walker about the conversation a week later, we get to ask what's said if they ask what's said. The state gets to go before the jury and say to the jury, hey, this Shanna Pact is being uncooperative and is in denial. We at the very least get to ask him why. One of his answers would have been that she was attempting to point the finger at someone else. That argument should have been available to us. If that's one of the first things she says and the state is relying upon her testimony and her credibility as an issue, at the very least, we should have a right to delve into that, flesh it out, ask questions about it, and give context to these so-called disclosures, give context to the spin that the state has put on these very important two conversations so that we can attempt to defend this case. As it relates to the on or about issue concerning analogous alibi evidence, it's true the natural mother did say there were times when they went back and forth. But before that, she'd said that the child stayed with her at her house until she was picked up to go to the hospital. And then on recross, it was locked in that that's the way it was, that this child stayed with her over the weekend and that she stayed there until she was picked up, and she didn't want to change her tune on that. I asked her if she was sure. She said yes. This comment that Fred Pack was the primary caregiver of Evelyn, or excuse me, of ESB, doesn't have any place as it relates to the weekend. The natural mother admitted that the reason that she was watching the child was because the grandmother was in the hospital and because Fred was working. Fred was working, and that's why she had to spend time with the child. On top of that, you have the child's testimony to Mike Bakley upon the very first interview. One of the first things that that she says to Mike Bakley is that she was staying with her mother when Shanna was in the hospital. With all that said, there was substantial evidence in the record which could have been used to try to argue to the jury that the very proof that the state was relying upon showed that it was impossible for the defendant to have committed these acts. That's where the due process violation comes in. We come into the trial, we're talking about these dates, we go through openings, we're talking about these dates, we go through the witnesses, we're talking about these dates, we get into closing, and the state gets to hold up a jury instruction and say, it doesn't matter, it can be reasonably close to these dates, and on top of that, you have a jury that can substantively utilize the videotape, and the videotape says it happened four times, and one time they thought was between Halloween and Thanksgiving. The simple fact of the matter is, as we went into this trial, we had one thing, and when we got to the end of it, there was quite another. That's the due process violation. As it relates to the sufficiency of evidence, I see I have some time left. I wanted to point out that this is the first case you will ever see where you have the complaining witness, when they're asked what happens, i.e. the sexual act, and they say nothing. Now, we can all step back and decide, well, you know, she was afraid, she may have said this, they can rely on the videotape, things like that. But we still have this testimony where, what did Fred's middle do to your middle? Nothing. How can the state rise above that? How can they rise above that? Do they get to step back, utilize the videotape, and say, hey, that's evidence enough? If they do get to do that, then you can see where the jury could utilize that videotape to find that some act occurred on some other occasion that would violate due process because of the pattern type on or about instruction. I also want to be clear that on this on or about instruction, it didn't say on or about. They took the on or about pattern and they switched the language out that said on or between, but then it had the line in there that it simply has to be reasonably close to the date and time alleged, not any definition of what's reasonably close. And I wanted to clarify that because it does kind of look like an error in my issue as I read through that. With all of that said, I would just ask that this court set some parameters on two things. Third-party perpetrator comes in every case. Prosecutors come in, they file it in every case, and every time a defense lawyer comes up and starts asking questions about where were you and what were you doing and what were you doing here, we're always shut down because we can't show that someone else was a third-party perpetrator. The rules are being blurred. The third-party perpetrator in limine ruling is in practical effect being utilized to disallow the appropriate cross-examination. That's what happened in this case, and I'd ask that you clarify that so that we don't continue to have this trouble on other cases.
What as it relates, test would you want us to clarify it, and so I'll ask you, what would we do to clarify it? Would you suggest a test that we would use that would say, this is how you distinguish third-party perpetrator evidence from reasonable cross-examination?
I think one of the ways that it needs to be clarified is this. I think we have to step back to the presumption of innocence and what it really means. You go into a case, you start off with a motion in limine preventing the possibility of third-party perpetrator information. What that really is a presumption of guilt. It's a presumption of guilt. There are circumstances. Let's assume that someone is wrongfully accused of an offense and they don't know who did it. They don't know who did it. How are they supposed to come in and show that there was a third-party perpetrator? The way this third-party perpetrator ruling has been utilized and the case law has been utilized is to be able to limit defense lawyers and how they question people when there's no way in the world we'd have that information if, in fact, we have an innocent person sitting in the courtroom and there's some unknown person out there who did that. With that said, one other thing needs to be clarified. When you're sitting in a jury trial, Laura Hawkins comes off as the nicest person in the world. The jurors just love her. She's very polite. She testifies well. They just eat her up. It's hard enough to cross-examine her without alienating the jury. But to have her sit up there and be given the testimony and ask her what she thinks, I'm just dead in the water at that point. There's just nothing I can do. So I would ask that these forensic interviewers be told and that the prosecutors be told to ask these general questions, and if they want to apply it to an alleged victim, you know, the case law allows that, but to step in and allow them, now my lips are sticking together, sorry. To step in and allow them to just take a .22 and shoot your defense. Just all the air comes out, sink, down we go in the water. And I guess my question is this. What if it really is a big deal? Isn't it radically different? Isn't it radically different if you have a little girl who says it never, ever happened? It never happened in one room. It always happened in this room. And they say that repeatedly. And then down the line, they say the opposite. Isn't that fair game for the defense lawyers? My point is this. If she's going to be allowed to testify to this, she's going to be asked what she thinks about every inconsistency throughout the cross-examination, and she is commenting on the testimony of witnesses. No other witness is allowed to do it. What do you think? He said this. What do you think about that? Objection sustained. With that, I would ask that you remedy this situation. I'd ask that it be remanded for a retrial. This is a life plus 25-year sentence. It's too long, and this trial wasn't fair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ranch. Court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.